Hi, and welcome to Music Production with Mike and Dan. In this episode, we're going to talk about 8-track recording. But before we get on to that, I wanted to go back to 4-tracking because there was one aspect to the 4-tracking that we left out. And that's what did our 4-tracks lead to? And in my case, my 4-tracks didn't really lead to anything other than just giving me experience and, you know, a tool to write on, a tool to...
Yeah, and start learning about production and sound and all the technical aspects.
Right, right. You know, caring a little bit more about engineering. Like if it was a serious 4-track session, then we would take a little bit more time to try to get a better sound. As opposed to if I was just inspired and just writing a song on the fly and I just didn't care about, you know, the tones... I just wanted to get the parts down.
Yeah, it was for documentation, so you can have the thing and show it to the rest of the band, blah, blah, blah.
Right, yeah. Right, exactly, yeah. You know, I got accolades from my friends, people I was working with, and even, you know, some people that I said, hey, you know, check out these songs or whatever, and it's like, wow, this is a 4-track? People used to always say that. This is a 4-track? Wow, this sounds really good for a 4-track, you know? So, I mean, that's as far as I got as far as accomplishing anything, I don't know, on a materialistic level. But you actually, you know, your first real level of success, right, came via your 4-track, right? So I didn't want to leave out the fact that with your 4-tracking, you know, a lot of doors opened for you.
Yeah, so once upon long ago, I scored a film called Sid and Nancy for director Alex Cox, and I...
Your first name drop right there.
Yeah, it's my first name. I'm going to drop his name a lot, so that's, yeah. So I don't think you have to drink every time I say his name.
But, yeah, I think I'd be wasted at that.
And so, yeah, and I wouldn't say that those 4-tracks sounded all that great, but they had a really good vibe to it. And so my sister actually also co-wrote that film. And so they went to school together. So I'd known both, well, I've known my sister for a really long time, but I've known Alex also for a long time, not quite as long. And so when they were in the midst of writing the Sid and Nancy, that film about Sid Vicious and Nancy Spungen, the doomed punk rock couple, I just said, oh, I should probably write some music for this thing. And so I wrote some demos based on the script using my Fostex X15 recorder.
Yeah, the X15, that's the one, yeah.
This was sort of like a little solo project that I was doing to submit demos to Sid, Nancy, and to Alex. And so I created stuff just based on reading the script and sent it to him, and he really loved it. And so him and the editor, a guy named David Martin, name drop if you're an English editor nerd, him and Alex like placed all the stuff that I'd written in entirely different scenes that I had envisioned. So...
Right.
And it seems they weren't even in the script. And so it was like, wow. But it worked really well. And so I got this weird lesson on like how film, you know, how music can affect film, you know, your film experience and all this weird stuff. And so they sent me the first rough cut that I saw of it actually had my demos already kind of placed in there.
So whose idea was it to use Taxi to Heaven with the dumpster kissing scene?
I believe that Alex credits David as like trying that, putting that scene in there.
Because that's a classic. I mean, that's, you know, that's film history right there.
It kind of is. In an independent way, it is definitely a sort of a classic thing, especially in my career and timeline. But yeah, so that was his call, you know, and Alex loved it. And so he gets credit for that for sure. And then other scenes, there's like a Asian sounding like Muzak thing that I had for a Chinese restaurant that ended up in this really long telephoto shot of the Sex Pistols coming over the hill in this really interesting sort of juxtaposition. And so, and why that works, I'm not really sure, but it really does.
Yeah.
And so those 4-tracks definitely. And from then on, you know, the rest is history. I kind of got other work doing film. The next film that we did was Straight to Hell for Alex. And that mostly, I don't, I think that was almost entirely for some reason I had Pulse 244 for all those demos. But those also ended up in the film. And in fact, one interesting thing is like those were so good that, you know, when we went to replace them in the studio, the second versions, there was at least one that Alex didn't like the studio, the nice clean redo of the version. And no, we're going to use the Tascam 4-track version, and that's what's in the film today. One of the cues that Xander, I can't remember if he wrote it or an arrangement of something that I did, but the version of it, it was a version of the main title's theme that he did on 4-track. And it was a much better take. It really sounds like a 4-track when you hear it in the movie.
And tell the listeners who Xander is, just so they know, because that's...
Oh, sorry, his name drop. Xander Schloss is my stepbrother. We've been stepbrothers from when we were really little kids.
And he's in a pretty well-known band.
Yeah, he's in Circle Jerks currently. He's... played with a lot of different bands, including the Weirdos. He played for a few years with Joe Strummer as his guitarist, and he's just arguably the best musician I know. We were never signed to Pray for Rain, but our demos, which we created on the 4-track, and the methods that we described last week, they got pretty far. They sounded pretty good.
Yeah,
they got us in the conversation with a few labels.
But in a way, you've had lasting success because of those 4-tracks, because you're still doing soundtracks today. And
yeah, but the Pray for Rain band, we did as a band, we also did 4-track demos. It helped.
A lot of people don't know this, but Taxi to Heaven, there's a version of it with lyrics and vocals, because you know, most people who hear that song in that very famous scene, it's just an instrumental. And I have a copy of that version with vocals, and I like it. So that's something that, you know, you guys took that song and brought it into your band, right? I mean, didn't you even play that song live? I think you played that song live.
Yeah, we played it live. And I mean, it was kind of a cynical afterthought, frankly. I mean, it actually holds up pretty well as a song. You like it, therefore it is good.
Right, because I like it, it's good, right?
That's basically my standard. It is another 4-track recording, so we kind of work in this podcast. But it was definitely something that I thought, we have this movie coming out, and I should have something we can do live. So yeah, same thing with Straight to Hell. Actually, there were tracks from that film that we had been playing in our set before the movie came out, and so that was actually those were sort of a more honest approach to sort of creating of doing a song a live,
right,
doing
right.
a live vocal song, because that was more organic, and this was. Definitely an afterthought, but it is an interesting piece still.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, obviously, like you said before, you guys were trying to get a record deal, you know?
Yeah, I had actually written another song, which we heard last week. That was something I tried to foist on Alex. Alex never liked it, though. So it's like he rejected the one that we heard last week, but this is from Taxi to Heaven, which is in the film. So I just decided to make a song out of that.
Right. And the song you're referring to from last week is Love Kills.
But Alex didn't like it, so...
And that's okay. I mean,
it is okay. No, I did the score for the film. It worked out really well.
Exactly. It's nice to, you know, to have a working relationship with people you trust, and they're not going to always like everything you do. And there's those times where you've really got your heart set on a song and you think everyone's going to love it, and it just snooze fest, you know?
Yeah. No.
And then you got those songs where you're like, I'm not even sure this is any good. And you sort of reluctantly include it, and everyone's like, that's the hit, you know?
Well, that's right. That's what happened with those demos for Sid and Nancy. And it was there was Roger Deakins, this cinematographer, who was the first to respond, I should add. There's a name drop. Academy Award winner,
yeah.
Roger Deakins. Deacons, he was the first one to hear that and was like, and responded to it when I gave it to Alex when they were shooting in San Francisco.
Right, right.
So he's definitely on the list of people I like.
We'll always be coming back to four tracks, not as a main topic, but just, you know, as an aside, because like we said last week, I mean, the whole thing starts with four. I mean, honestly, with me, sound recording started with an old Sound on Sound tape recorder. Maybe we'll do a Sound on Sound episode later on. But that was my first experience with sound recording, was just being able to overdub in some way. You know, it wasn't even tracks. It was just like Sound on Sound, which a lot of you probably don't even know what that is, but we'll save that for another day. For me, after four tracking, my next real significant step up was eight tracking, obviously. My first eight track recording experience was actually, we're back in Miami Beach now. There was a guy who lived on one of the islands. When you drive towards Miami Beach, there's like some series of islands, but his name was Phil Cohen. And he was kind of like this rich guy, or his parents were rich, I should say. And he expressed an interest in becoming a recording engineer. His favorite band was the Beatles. So see, that's the same old thing. Uh-huh. And they built for him sort of, you know, an addition to his house, and that he used more or less as a studio, and he had some really good gear. I mean, this guy, you know, he knew good gear, you know, even back then. And he had a nice, I think it was a 1-inch 8-track deck. And I went in there and recorded a couple songs with the same drummer I was using for the earlier 4-track stuff.
And you paid how much? Just, do you remember how much you paid?
Oh, I can't remember. Gosh, maybe 10 bucks an hour or something. It wasn't mm-hmm. much, mm-hmm. you know? But in this instance, I wasn't engineering. Phil was engineering. And also sort of co-producing. But I, of course, they were my songs, and you know, I knew what I wanted to do guitar-wise and vocal-wise, but it was my first experience with 8-track. Once again, I didn't, you know, this is before I had any real experience in knowing the tricks, you know, the tricks of 8-tracking.
Mm-hmm. Back when I was in St. Louis, we recorded on 8-track.
And so was this band the first band you're in out of high school? Or something like that? Or?
Yeah, in high school. So in high school, my band at the time was called The Strikers. Kind of a Clash-ish, Jam-ish thing. Not completely original, but we had our moments. But yeah, so literally in high school, we kind of remember $200 being the cost for this recording, an 8-track recording studio that my dad lent me or something. and we went in and we recorded, I think, 4 or 5 songs on 8-track and put it out as a single. And so, and it's out there. You can buy it.
Wow. Okay. I didn't know that.
I mean, I don't know if you can buy it, but I've seen them on eBay before. Just as sort of like this punk rock relic.
Right,
a dubious thing to be a relic, but anyway.
But you were just a musician in that session, right? You weren't engineering or producing, were you?
No. But it was the first time I ever saw a console that was more than I never saw. I don't think I've ever seen a console. So they had like, I don't remember the board, or Trident, possibly. More likely something like a Soundcraft or something. You know, early 80s. And the guy who we paid, he produced it. I didn't even know what a producer was at the time. So he just produced it. I think he produced some other punk rock bands and it came out good. And so we had him. Ours didn't come out so good, I don't think. Still not happy with it. But I didn't know anything at all. And he had an engineer that knew even less than he did and less than about as much as I did. He just sort of did what he was told. But there was isolation and there was drums and we recorded everything live and overdubbed a solo, as I recall. And it was 8-track. I don't know if there was any bouncing or not. I don't recall anything like that. I think it was mostly just drums to a few tracks and then bass. And we were a three-piece, so it actually, it was easier. But yeah, so that was the first eight-track experience that I had. And
did you double any guitars? I mean, because with a three-piece band, you know, you certainly would have had tracks open for something like that, right?
No, I didn't know anything about, we should have. It could actually, listening to it in retrospect, I have doubling those guitars would have been a great idea. But Tim didn't have, and the only reason I know his name is because I looked up, is that record, what was that guy's name? And it, somewhere that record's out there, and so his name is on there.
Right, right.
And it says, the internet says that it's on Simplex Records, and as I recall, they would just ask you if you wanted to have this on your, so it looked like you were on a label, it wasn't actually a label.
Yeah.
So when you paid them the money to actually make the, to press the records, they would put that on there if you wanted.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And so it's like, we were on, it says here we're on Simplex Records, which doesn't, it's just sort of a fake record label.
Yeah. When I was living in New York and I was in this band called The Chairs, and we did some eight-track recording in Uptown Manhattan. And now it was more because of the experience I had achieved with my four-tracking, and the other two guys in the band knew that I was pretty good at that, you know, getting, you know, just doing interesting things with four-track. So when we went to the eight-track, they sort of, you know, instantly said, okay, Mike, you're the guy. I think the first session we did, there was a house engineer there, but the other two guys in the band looked at me and said, well, you know, we're relying on you to get a good recording for us. I think that was the first time I was in a studio, an eight-track studio, where I was doing engineering and producing and, you know, getting that kind of experience.
Did you feel the pressure of being in a recording studio at that time?
A little bit. I mean, you know, not so much for myself. I mean, like, in other words, if I was doing one of my own songs and I was just in there, I wouldn't feel any pressure. But because I had two bandmates and, you know, they sort of, they had expectations, you know, they were like, well, come on, you got to figure it out. You're the guy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that eight tracking, you know, it was... There was certain things about, I learned about eight tracking. First of all, you know, we were recording live drums, which I think I said before that most of my four tracks were drum machine. So, you know, recording live drums was a whole art form in and of itself.
Yep.
That I really needed to learn so much more about that, you know.
Right, you're really good at it now, I might tell the listeners.
Yeah,
no, that's where you excel as far as your engineering goes, in my opinion, so yeah.
Then lastly, I moved to San Francisco in the mid-80s, and I wound up, here's another name drop, I wound up working in a studio called Dancing Dog Recording Studio that was run by Dave Bryson, who is now the guitar player of Counting Crows. What I'm trying to get to here is that Dancing Dog Recording Studio eventually had an extra studio that Dave Bryson built, sort of like off to the side from the 16 track. So there was the 16 track room, and then there was this little eight track sort of area that was partitioned off. And this was a Fostex eight track, the same machine you have that I currently have in my closet. What is the number on that? That's the, do you remember that?
An R8?
An R8, yeah.
I could be wrong. I think here I can.
Yeah, so there, it's a quarter-inch eight-track, which kind of sucks in a way. I mean, you know, I feel like quarter-inch is good for four-tracking, but not so much eight-tracks. But, you know, it's a good little machine.
Yeah, tell that to the, like, there seems to be, like, the Tascam 388 desk that has a mixer built in became, like, the go-to thing in, like, the indie rock world. I mixed a record on that. It came out okay, it sounds okay, but it's like, it became such a trendy, and I think it still is. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah,
388,
yeah.
It was like had a reel-to-reel. It looked like a Porta Studio, a big Porta Studio.
But the reel-to-reel was internal.
was internal.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, and those, like, I know a lot of people that had those became really trendy, and I was like, back when those came out, we thought those sucked. But now, there's like a lot of kind of famous records that are lo-fi records that came out in the aughts into the teens that had that.
They're still around.
It's a big, that Tascam 388, I believe.
Yeah. A friend of mine had one of those back in around that time, like the early 2000s. And, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's but for what I was doing back in the late 80s, early 90s, that Fostex quarter inch 8-track was like gold, you know. that was the machine that I really, you know, my engineering and production skills just went up 2-3 notches on that thing.
And that was the same model that, same model that you have of mine now.
Yeah. Yeah, the same exact machine. Yeah, yeah.
That sounds about right.
And he had it set up in such a way where we had an Alesis drum machine, and he had a SMPTE code generator. So he had it sort of set up in such a way. I'm talking about Dave Bryson.
Uh-huh.
He called it his songwriter's studio. And he said, you know, a lot of times with his band at the time, which was a band called Mr. Dog, came before. Some of the same people were in Mr. Dog that wound up in Counting Crows. But he said, you know, sometimes, you know, we get inspired and we want to write songs and, you know, we have the 16 track, but he goes, I want to keep the 16 track open for, because he had other engineers who worked there. And he said, you know, I want to keep it open for business. He said, so that's what gave him the idea to do the 8-track. So it's like songwriting was exclusively done in the 8-track room. And then once you had everything demoed up, then you would go to the 16 track and do like a real recording with live drums and everything. And so I was working there, you know, I was one of the engineers who worked there, and he said, yeah, you know, you can go in there whenever you want, as long as it isn't booked or whatever. And so, and that's exactly what I did. I wrote songs, and it was perfect for me. It was so perfect because I could just go in there, and I usually went there at night, you know, during the graveyard shifts, and I could just write a song, you know, and just throw everything down, throw all the tracks down.
And were you using, was it all just live recording, or were you using, or did you stripe SMPTE and like use and sync up things with that?
So that's what I was going to say, was that it was sort of defaulted that way. It was like, in other words, if you didn't want to use the SMPTE, you'd have to unhook it, which I never wanted to do. So when I started a new song, the first thing I would do is I had a whole bunch of quarter inch tape, you know, that I bought. And so I'd go
in. What do you mean it was? I mean, you still had to stripe up. You still had to put down timecode onto it. It didn't do that by itself, did it?
No. What I'm saying is the way he had everything set up, everything was pre-wired.
I see.
Yeah, it was hardwired that way. And I didn't want to go behind the thing and start unplugging stuff. And, you know, so I just said, okay, well, if that's the way the studio's set up, that's the way we're going to do it. Now, there were a few instances where, you know, I went in there with a drummer or percussionist. I wasn't going to record a whole drum kit, but sometimes we'd overdub a snare or something or some percussion. I don't know. But for the most part, a session usually started with, you know, striping track 8 with SMPTE. And then, you know, once that was done, then you set your tempo. And then, you know, once you know what the tempo of the song is going to be. And then you got your Alesis drum machine and you spend a little bit of time coming up with some generic beats, you know, write a few generic beats on the Alesis. And then you'd have your groove, and then the Alesis drum machine would be playing live. And I think I had 4 outputs. So I had 4 tracks of drums. I mean, not tracks, of course, 4 channels. mm-hmm. that were playing live from the Alesis, which was nice. I mean, because it was like I sacrificed one track and I got four right. channels of drums for sacrificing.
This would all go back into a mixer. And then what was your eventual mixdown medium in those days?
Oh, it was a two-track, reel-to-reel. Yeah. So basically we had the four channels of drums. So I had kick, snare, and then stereo overheads coming out of the Alesis. And then I had seven more tracks to play with, you know? And just mm-hmm. like what we said in the four tracking episode, once again, seven tracks isn't that much. And while I didn't really need to do a lot of bouncing, because I did want to retain the integrity of the, you know, things being in stereo and stuff like that. I didn't want to have too many instruments frozen in mono or, you know, yeah. on one track. But when you have seven tracks, and now I think I use this term linear, and meaning just from beginning to end, you have just one open track, you know, you do sort of start to run out of tracks pretty quickly. Seven just isn't that many tracks. And so I found myself doing the same thing on the eight track that I did on the four track, which was, you know, using up those tracks. If there was an open space on any given track at any time, I figured out, you know, it's like, okay, I can add a little keyboard part here or something like that, or a harmony or a little oohs or ahs or something, you know, just to get the most out of those seven tracks, you know.
Sure. And did you do, other than the drum machine, were you syncing anything else?
No. See, that's the thing. Now, I really didn't. I was kind of, I wouldn't say anti, but I never really embraced sequencing. Mm-hmm. You know, MIDI, MIDI was even came out earlier than the SMPTE stuff.
It's just a fad. It's going to go away. That MIDI thing is going to be gone.
Right. It's a very useful tool, and you know, we all use it to this day.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it?
But at the time, I was, you know, the kind of music I was playing, first of all, was still more rock. And I mean, I could have used MIDI for some of my keyboard parts, I guess, but I just preferred to play them. I just preferred to have
no the drum. The drum machine was the only kind of way you embrace this kind of technology, and that was just because it was practicality,
right? And I didn't, you know, Bryson was so nice. I mean, he's such a sweet guy, and you know, he let me go in there, and he said, just, you know, drop a few bones down every once in a while. Like, it wasn't, you know.
Right.
Leave $20, you know, whatever. It's just for wear and tear. But it really, I mean, it opened doors for me, you know, because I practically lived in that. As a matter of fact, at one point, I was considering moving away from San Francisco, you know, going back to New York or maybe going back to Miami. And it was that studio that kept me in the Bay Area. That was literally the only thing. I was like, well, I can't, you know, I've got such a good situation here with this recording set up. So that's it for this week. Next week, we're going to stay with this topic on 8-tracking, and we're going to talk about our record deal with MCA. It's 63 minutes. I really think this is going to be cut down. If you like this podcast, please subscribe. Leave us 5 stars and a review. Thanks.